But I like phoning it in on the Sophisticates because we get to talk.
We phone it in, but we don't phone it in.
Bingo.
Yes, exactly.
That's our new motto. Howdy, folks. Welcome to another episode of The Sophisticates, the greatest conversational podcast of all time, as voted by the hosts of The Sophisticates. I'm Matt Patches, and with me, as always, are my co-hosts, Rajan Mudambi.
I'm here, and this is definitely my favorite.
Yes, your vote podcast. For number one conversational podcast
number
of all time.
Number one, all the way.
And Ryan Pfister.
Part-time tax accountant reporting for duty.
Yes. Pfister is currently at his grandmother's house doing her taxes. I needed to point out that embarrassing fact. That's not embarrassing. You're a great-grandson.
I do what I can.
You're the number one grandson as voted by the Sophisticates hosts. Well, we have three amazing topics per usual, so we should jump right in. Number one, the Kindle, a judgment shield.
So this topic began a few months back when I began reading a book called Tally's Corner. And this is a book about an anthropologist in the 60s who studies a group of people that hang out on a street corner and appear to not do much work. And he sort of investigates basically how it's basically a problem of economic incentives, where these jobs pay so little that in many cases it's almost not worth trying at the jobs, especially because there's no opportunity for advancement. But the problem is that, you know, this book, the subtitle on this book was written in the 60s, is called, I think it's called A Study of Negro Street Corner Men, you know. And so I think it's actually a very tolerant, progressive book, but from the cover, it actually looks like it's sort of a derogatory or racist book.
Wait, is there a picture on the cover?
Yeah, I think there's a picture of like a few people milling around.
Black people?
Yeah.
So your worry is you're this scrawny white guy, gangly white man riding on a train or something, and you're reading a book that has Negro in the title with black people mulling about on the cover. And even though, you know, it's a progressive book, you're worried about the judgment of others.
That's correct.
I see.
This basically brought up a topic that we began discussing later about whether you could read books like this more casually or more discreetly on a Kindle, and we broaden it to other books that you might be just more embarrassed perhaps to be reading, like if you wanted to read children's books, or if you wanted to read the Harry Potter books and for some reason you were sensitive about being behind the times and reading them, or if you actually wanted to read books that were outrightly racist or derogatory or something.
Finally, you can read Mein Kampf in the, yeah, the comfort of your commute.
Well, I mean, to use a practical example, I was on the metro the other day, and the woman next to me was reading a book about prayers to exorcise demons.
Not on her Kindle, you mean?
That's this was sort of topic, guys. Come on, let's be understanding.
Literature of today. You found yourself judging her.
I was just a little freaked out because, I mean, one, if it was false, I mean, she's either a little bit crazy, or she's actually possessed by demons. And in either case, I did not want to sit next to her.
It might be that she just knows someone who's possessed, Pfister.
Yeah.
That's true. Oh.
She's studying for her finals. She's in school. But that's interesting to me because you've now found yourself in the position of the other role where you are judging. But do you prefer, like, would you be less scared if she was reading it on a Kindle? Obviously, because you wouldn't know.
I wouldn't know. I mean, I think you can go both ways because on one hand, I could see that, yeah, you get more discretion personally in your book reading preferences. But on the other hand, I think that's a great thing about like reading a book on an airplane is sometimes you can chat with the other person about that book.
Yeah, well, see, I kind of approach it from that standpoint. That I mean, I like living in New York because it's a people watching capital. You know, there's so many weirdos, and it's just a great place to just see people in their natural setting doing whatever they want, and like you'll see type of person reading the exact opposite of what you might guess they would be reading, and like your mind goes wild. Like I love thinking about what people are like and based on what they're reading or something. And the Kindle kind of it keeps things shrouded in mystery. You know, we're all you know, there's no information out there in the world. Everything's kept behind a shield.
I agree with that. When I'm on the train, I do enjoy if someone's reading something, you know, taking a peek and seeing what that book is, and you know, seeing if I've read the book or what are you reading? What sort of book are you reading? Or like, are you reading Nora Roberts? Or are you reading Dostoevsky? You know, like what? You know, it's fun.
It also could prompt you to go and check the book out. It's bad marketing. Kindle is destroying book marketing in some capacity.
It's possible, yeah.
It's also, you can't really peek over someone's shoulder and see the Kindle either. Or, like, it's hard to...
You have to really be, like, looking over their shoulder to do that. And even then, I don't know, do they always have the book title on the top?
No, I don't think they ever do, actually.
You would have to know what the content of the book
You would
is.
Have to memorize character names and do a detailed Google search when you return home.
I wonder if they could make a social version of the Kindle that displayed the book title on the other side.
I can't imagine that showing off what you're reading is ever going to be a priority to the tech people who are inventing this stuff or spending the money to create these things. But it really is, you are losing something. And I can understand being worried about reading the book that you were reading that one time, Pfister, on the train. And, you know, I'm sure you were worried about, like, getting in a fight or something. You know, like, you were worried about the judgment and the consequences it could have, but there's so much you lose by doing that. You're better off getting in that fight or having consequences, the taking of the risk by reading this book in an open place.
Sort of depends. I guess it depends on how much I viewed my physical danger.
Well, did you? I mean, why were you worried? Why were you worried about the judgment in the first place?
Well, because I ride the metro through the rough part of town to get to where I work.
The rough part of town.
This is well, I mean, people used to get shot at the metro station where I get off, or mugged and stuff. So, I didn't feel so unsafe that I wouldn't read it.
I'm just saying that I think we need the judgment of others, or we need to be okay with being open. You don't want to, you don't want, because if your inclination is, I don't want people to know what I'm reading because I'm afraid of what they'll think, then you'll start keeping everything hidden, and there's no discovery.
That's true. Maybe the real problem is that you need to be okay with reading the book in public. You just need to be able to be proud of your reading choices.
Yeah, like, well, I applaud this woman who was trying to exorcise demons or taking notes on demon possession or whatever while you were on the train. She's owning it.
And a kind of slightly different note, it is... This Kindle kind of clouding what you're reading is, in my opinion, that's kind of only a progression of what's been happening. Because in some ways, this is just the literary equivalent of an iPod or something. Because, though admittedly, you probably weren't just carrying a boombox on the train and listening to your music so everyone could hear it. But
see the boombox episode. I had to annotate that, yeah.
Exactly. But... It's in another way you're kind of concealing your musical tastes because you can't. It's very difficult to just kind of like peep over someone's shoulder and see what they're playing on their iPod, unless they're playing it obnoxiously loud that you can hear it through their earbuds, in which case they're going deaf. But you know,
yeah. I mean, it's not exactly the same because I don't think seeing the cover of a book is ever obtrusive.
Yeah, that's true. But it is in the concealing manner. It's the same sort of principle.
But I think it hurts people. I mean, I think about going to the beach the year that the girl with the dragon tattoo was exploding, like one or two years ago. And you walk down the beach and everyone has a copy of that book. And you're like, holy crap, that's how the phenomenon took off. Like, everyone was reading that book because they saw everybody reading that book. And they're like, I got to read this book. And then the Kindle doesn't allow you to do that. Now you see you walk the beach and everyone just has their Kindle. And it's like, what are you reading?
Do people take Kindles to the beach? Because like I feel
yeah,
like
you take Kindle to the beach.
I feel like I would not want to take electronics to a place where there is just lots of sand and water.
Well, but, I mean, it's you're not like bringing it in the pool or bringing it in the ocean.
I guess something. Not, but
it doesn't really have a lot of parts to it. I don't think you can get a lot of sand in the Kindle.
Here's the ironic thing is that actually there's more tools now than ever to digitally share with your friends what books you are reading and what articles you are reading.
Right, there are social media tools to do that, but not through Kindle, I don't think.
But not with the general public. Also, you know, there's no casual discovery. It's only your friends.
Right. It's a closed circle.
Oh, woe for society.
Well, it's a closed circle, but it's not really a closed circle because all your friends aren't only friends with your friends. So it does diffuse perfectly well. That's the whole point of all this 6 degrees separation and networking.
It's a web.
So it's a web.
It's a worldwide web.
And you're not gonna necessarily see what person X is reading, but person X may post this on their Facebook or something, or talk about this book on some social media, and it's highly possible that will get to you.
I see. So not all is lost because we can post on our Facebooks that we're reading books, and instead of people seeing it on the train or in a park, we can now just look on social media tools.
Oh, but you do still miss out on that, like, kind of momentary, like, people watching sort of gratification, because right. That's going to be gone. I don't think that's coming back.
So, Pfister, do you own a Kindle?
I do not.
Are you going to get one so that you can start reading books that make other people uncomfortable?
No. I'm just going to take your advice and own the books. Own my reading preferences.
I commend you, and I want you to report back in case you do get in some sort of kerfuffle.
I will be sure you are the first to know.
Thank you. After the police. Anyway, why don't we move on to topic number two for today? When should you listen to drunk people? This is prompted by an experience that I had the other night. It was 3:30 in the morning. I'm asleep, and I start hearing this really loud banging on my door, just pounding. And I go and answer, and there's this chick who lives across the hall from me, or up the stairs. And she's drunk, and she just got back from the club, and so she's in her club outfit. And I'm like, what the hell are you doing? And she's locked out of her apartment. And it's raining out, and she's like, I gotta get into my apartment. I lost my keys. I lost everything. And I'm like, oh, Jesus. And she's like, what I really need is a screwdriver. And I don't understand why, but her plan is I'm going to take a screwdriver and open the gate on the window next to her apartment door. And I'm going to take the gate off, and she's going to climb through the window and kind of reach out to her apartment window and climb into it because she knows there's a screen there that she can open and, you know, get in. And obviously, my reaction to this is there's absolutely no way I'm going to allow you to do this. You're crazy. And then I spent about half an hour she's convincing me I'm a great climber. I'm not that drunk. It's not that far of a distance. And she's not letting me go. And I keep telling her, stay in my apartment, whatever. But no, she's committed. She's going to climb out this window, whether I'm going to help her or not. Point of the story is, I got to a point where I actually did take the gate off the window to allow her to climb. And then I'm like, no, what am I thinking? This girl's going to get herself killed. It's raining. She's going to slip. The window's too far. There's no way. But I did allow myself to kind of be convinced by this drunk person that that was okay. And maybe it was because it was 3:30 in the morning. But I started thinking about when you should actually listen to drunk people. And I guess that's the push for drunk driving. Like, no, just because they say they can doesn't mean they can. But It expands. That idea of listening to drunk people expands because it's not always about doing something that might be dangerous. It might just be about saying something that they mean or don't mean, or revealing a truth that might not be a truth. And I'm kind of curious what you think about listening to people when they're in an inebriated state, whether they can ever be honest or whether they're always honest.
In general, they think they're being honest. and especially when it comes to doing things, they firmly believe they're capable of doing it. And they probably are capable of doing it in a sober state, though they may not actually try it. Like, I don't know if she would have tried to climb through this window if she were sober, but she probably could have done it.
Right. But my worry, too, is, like, this person is drunk, so she's probably going to do it anyway. And if I leave, so it's like, maybe I should listen to this drunk person and help her actually achieve her goal. And maybe I should believe that she's capable of doing it.
Well, for me, I always view the main thing for a drunk person is just the shut off of long-term consequences. Like, I think it's a complete filter of ability to think long-term. It's only about immediate gratification. So, I don't know how correct this is, but I always interpret it as like, well, maybe they like you now, but in their sober state, they realize or think for some reason that it's not going to work out. So that's why they haven't said, I love you when they're sober.
But does that mean you should take it honestly? Like, you should believe them? Because since they don't understand the consequences of what they're doing and they're only thinking in the immediate, it almost, you can't judge them outside of that.
Well, I mean, I think it's sort of like what Rajan said. Like, it's at some level that they love you, but it's not, I mean, if it's not their conscious mind, it, like, doesn't even really matter.
Patches, are people just coming up to you when they're drunk saying they love you? Is that what this is about?
I get that a lot. That didn't come up during the time when I was opening the gate to allow a drug person to climb out their window. But it could have. I could have seen it happen.
You did it for love, not because she was drunk.
You know, if someone makes a submission and what you're saying makes perfect sense to me, that, you know, they might love you a little or they might feel bad a little bit, and they're just overreacting because they're not in their mind. But do you take that piece of information and take it seriously enough that when they're not like that anymore, you actually engage them about it again when they're not in that state?
I think that's prudent. Well, it depends. Like, if they said they're going to kill themselves, yeah, I think it would be prudent to follow up afterwards.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense.
If they say they love you, I think you have to be much more. I think you just have to let that play out and see if it develops into something conscious. I don't think you can discuss it, or it will get really awkward.
But do you have to take action in that moment too? Because in this case, this girl wants to climb out a window, and like I said, if I left and let her to kind of do her own thing, because she wouldn't lay on my couch, you know, she would probably try and find another way to climb out the window. So what do you do? Do you say that they're drunk and you should, or do you try and help them so they can do this thing by themselves, which they're committed to doing? Or do
If we take the drunk driver analogy,
yeah,
when they say that they're able to drive, what you have to do is drive them home. So in this case, Patches, you should have climbed out the window and let her into her apartment. That's what
she could have crawled on my back and I could have jumped out the window. luckily we don't have to deal with too many drunk drivers in New York City, but this is the equivalent of that, and it scared me. I don't know when to listen to drunk people. I guess this is obvious. I should stop listening to them.
I just consider their drunk statements for use later, or for follow-up on later in a sober state.
So you do follow-up about them?
Some of them, like if they say they're going to kill themselves.
I'm trying to think of something that someone would say that you would not follow up on.
Like, never, like not follow up on at all?
Yeah, that you would be like, that cannot be true. And that you should probably not say anything later.
I think you could take anything they say when they're drunk and just sort of discuss it later. If you think that it wouldn't be awkward to discuss. And just see if they don't completely write it off or not. But we're missing the end of this. What happened unless you undid the gate?
So, I undid the gate, and then what happened was I tried to put it back on because I told her that there was no way I was going to let her do this. And she was, like, staring at me and crying because it's like all she wanted to do was go into the apartment. And I felt really bad about it. Like, I felt like I should do it because she's so upset and so committed to doing it that I kind of broke down, and that's why I opened the gate in the first place. And then I tried to put it back on, and I kind of broke the gate, so I pretended to do it. That was the biggest problem. The biggest problem was that I broke the gate, and now she could theoretically take it off herself if I just left her there and climb out the window. So I really did enable her. But then I convinced her to sleep on my couch. But okay. There was a problem.
All right. Happy ending.
she didn't fall to her death.
Yeah. Well, I was definitely worried, you know, now I've committed a crime if she dies. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Are you dating this girl now, Matt?
No, this is not. No, I am not.
So she didn't say she loved you in the end.
No, there were no admissions of that sort. But I guess I'm an idiot. I guess what this comes down to, this whole topic, is really that I'm an idiot and you should never listen to drunk people. And this is not even a question. You should never listen to drunk people.
No, I don't think that needs to be the takeaway.
The takeaway is that you can use their, you have to validate their input when they're sober, and use it as a source of how they might feel emotionally without considering long-term consequences. But you should never enable them to put themselves in physical danger while drunk.
Yes.
But just even if they really think they can do it?
No.
That makes a lot of sense. Well, I've learned an important lesson, and I'm embarrassed, and we should move on to topic number 3. Phoning it in.
So our discussion of phoning it in began at just, I actually did not know what phoning it in was until recently, and it's when you it's a metaphor of somebody just dialing into a conference call as opposed to showing up for the meeting. And, you know, this is mostly a derisive term of somebody who's not trying very hard. But I sort of look at it from the other sense of, are there certain jobs, and I felt this way sometimes, where I'll go into a job and I will get really into it, probably too into it, and really overachieve at it. And I think that subconsciously, when I really try my hardest at a job, I sort of need everybody else to also be invested in it in order to like feel good about what I did. And I think that in some situations, I kind of wanted to talk about this a little bit, whether it's rational to just try to care a little bit less about that particular job that you're doing. And maybe you would be happier that way if good enough is enough to satisfy the goal in that particular job.
Well, I feel like I deal with the same problem, just that I'm wired to always push myself to like do beyond the best or something, like it maximize quality. But and it starts with, I think we're taught to never phone it in. You know, we're instilled with the idea of like always give it your all, give it 100%, give it 110%. And we're kind of trained to think that we should always do the best at everything. But I agree with that. I'm always also expecting everyone around me to kind of feel that way. I feel that similarly, Fister. But I agree that I think your brain, you strain yourself trying to do that, and that maybe there's it's not necessarily prioritizing, it's figuring out a way to do enough based on how much you should be caring about it in the context of the rest of your life.
Yeah, I agree with that in the sense that I think a lot of people lose sight of, I do think a lot of people lose sight of the importance of what they're doing. And they get caught up in it and throw like so much of themselves into their job or their task. And I feel like they miss out, though, because they miss out on, you know, what else there is in life. It's probably more of a problem on a personal level, I think, than on a macro level, since I don't think there's anything societally wrong in people working hard and doing better in their job than they should have, you know. But you know, you have to think about it in terms of an incremental sort of like marginal gains sort of situation, like view. And that if you give 90% effort, you'll accomplish, you can get like 90% of your potential with a certain amount of effort. But in order to get to 93%, you need to like double the amount of work that you did. And at some point, you need to take a step back and think, was it worth that extra 3% to lose, like, you know?
Yeah, but how do you know that? How would you know that?
How would you know what? That you're only going to get incremental returns?
Yeah.
I mean, I suppose, like, sometimes it's hard to tell, like, when you're not at that, like, you know, kind of threshold. Where, you know, minimal additions in effort will actually affect substantial improvements in the quality. But I do think you figure it out based on just kind of trial and error, and having worked and having done things in your life, you realize that when I spend 10 hours on this type of project, I get this sort of result. When I spend 15 hours, this is the sort of result.
Yeah, but I always ask myself, like, why would anyone phone it in? Why would I not do this to the best of my abilities? It's hard for me to convince myself that anything should be not half-assed, but done just enough.
I think it comes down to partly priorities and partly just, you know, the lack of, you know, you only have so much time to do things. And if you devote all of your efforts to some tasks, or say your job or whatever, then you don't have that effort to apply in some other field or some other medium or of some other aspect of your life.
I think that's the struggle, is, you know, figuring out, oh, you know, hypothetically, mentally, I know if you don't need to spend that much time on this particular task to get it done right. And I guess I've seen, you know, books and stuff like that where they say, you know, if it's your job, you know, put in what you need to do to get it done, but then do other things that you're really passionate about beyond that. But I think that's not always easy to do on, like, a personal level. Like, I think that in many situations you just want to have a job that you really care about and just go all out there.
Yeah. But even if the job that you're doing right now isn't what you want, Ryan, don't you feel that you're still the push to do it the best, like to make it that job for you? Like, it's almost a desire to turn that job into the ideal job that you're talking about by giving it your all.
Well, yeah, I think it's actually separate. Yeah, you know, whether it's a job that you really care about or not, or, and whether you still feel compelled to do the best at it. I think you could not like a job but still feel like you need to get done what needs to get done correctly.
You know, if you're the type of person who does a really good job with everything, and then you try and step back and give enough, then won't you be seen as, like, you're dropping in quality as a contributor to this, to either your job or whatever you're starting to pull back on? You're not as good as you were. You set a bar for yourself by giving it your all.
That is definitely true. Once people get an expectation of what you're going to do, then
you can't almost just start
regardless
it in.
Of what almost regardless of what that bar you set was, you have to match it. So if you started your job and were, I mean, obviously you have to meet a certain level of productivity or you're just going to get fired. But as soon as if you like develop an expectation of this is how much work I'm willing to do, and I'm going to work weekends and I'm going to work till 10 p.m. every night and whatever. Once you stop doing that, people are going to be a little bit, I don't think they can say anything because you're still doing your job.
Right. Well, that's what I think people are afraid of.
But they're definitely, it's going to be something that they're going to be thinking about.
People are afraid to tell the people they work with that they're being overworked because of that fear. And sometimes it ends, you know, that could lead to you getting fired. But, you know, I have interns at my job who sometimes they feel like they can't eat lunch because they're too busy. And I tell them that is absurd. That is 100% absurd. You must take a lunch. You must walk away. You can't work all the time, whether you think you have to or not. And they want to give it their all. But I told them, for your own well-being, you have to not, you can't. You can't do 100% the best job because the expectations are too high and you have to under-deliver in order to balance.
In that case, with the intern sort of situation, people, like, they're working to get this job, more or less, or get the recommendations or whatever, so they feel that...
Sure, but I have coworkers who are the same way.
I think it's a little more understandable in the intern situation because they're only there for a short period of time and they want to make an impression, right? But if it's your actual job where you're there long term, then I think you have to pace yourself. You're going to burn out. Isn't that true?
Yeah. So, Ryan, are you going to start phoning it in?
No. I think I'll always pursue opportunities where nobody's phoning it in.
phoning it in is like a is bad. You shouldn't phone anything in.
Oh yeah, I think unless that it goes to a level below the acceptable level.
Although no, I don't. I disagree. I don't think phoning it in is negative, is detrimental to the company or to the job or to the task. I think phoning it in is just enough, right?
I guess it depends what you mean.
I guess that's semantics.
What phoning it in means to you. I don't know. But
I think it's more of a question of mental state, the phoning in.
Yeah.
Like do you not, I do not care whether this is done to a high standard.
Yeah. I think
I'm not invested in this task.
I'm doing it because I have to do it, and I'm just going to kind of skate along, and I don't really care if I improve the product or anything. I just want to do this because I have to do it.
But we think that's bad.
That is a negative mentality, and it's not going to lead to, it can't lead to good work.
But you can have an attitude where you say, you know what, the work that I'm going to put into this job, I do not need it to improve the job, or I do not need it to help the company be successful, but I do not need it to ruin the company. You can have that mentality, I think, and be positive and be a player, a team player.
Yeah, yeah, but then again, at that point, you do care about the product. You just don't, like, the fact that if the product were to completely fail, that would be a problem to you.
Right, right. Well, but that's not phoning it in. That's letting things slip off and fall off the edge. I think phoning it in, I think if you're going to phone something in, you better have something you're giving your all to somewhere else in your life. And then that means you're phoning it in is being justified in some capacity.
Yeah, I think so.
So you can't phone it in everywhere.
Or phoning it in if it's a temporary state. Like if you're just kind of phoning it in this week because you're a little frazzled or whatever, but you're going to pick it back up after you get a little bit of a break. That could be acceptable too.
No, it sounds like our summation is that you have to get off the telephone for something.
Yes.
You can't phone everything in, or you shouldn't, probably.
Yep.
Well, maybe we should get off the phone then and and go out and live our lives. But I like phoning it in on the Sophisticates because we get to talk.
We phone it in, but we don't phone it in.
Bingo.
Yes, exactly.
That's our new motto. Well, I think that about wraps us up for today. Fister, how are the hair escapades going for you?
Oh, I am definitely going to need to get it done this weekend.
I thought you just had a haircut.
No, I had it like a month ago at least.
Do you get a monthly haircut?
Well, it's always in flux. You know, I got a long haircut last time. Like, I didn't take very much off.
What?
They didn't cut it very short.
Oh, they just gave you a snip.
Yeah, and then it looked pretty good for a while, but I think that it was somewhat of a bad haircut because it quickly got shaggy. Like, I think that I have this new theory now that a really good haircut will actually develop better over time.
It gains a character of its own? Or
well, it just becomes self-aware. It will become longer, but it will still look okay longer. It will not become shaggy and look bad.
Oh, what it takes to be a dapper man. Well, that about wraps things up for this week's episode. Remember to subscribe to us on iTunes, leave a review, leave some comments. It helps us out. Follow us on the Tumblr, thesophisticates.tumblr.com, Twitter @Sophisticast, and tune in 2 weeks. We'll be back.